It was her father who had arranged her marriage to Duraid al-Simma. It was the last thing that he had done for her before his death. She had known he was dying at the time, and she had not found it in her heart to defy him. All her modern training made her want to resist the old-fashioned Coptic tradition of the arranged marriage, but her breeding and her family and her church were against her. She had acquiesced. Her marriage to Duraid had not proved as insufferable as she had dreaded it might be. It might even have been entirely comfortable and satisfying if she had never been introduced to romantic love. However, there had been her liaison with David while she was up at university. He had swept her up in the hurly-burly, in the heady delirium, and in the end the heartache when he had left her to marry a blonde English rose, approved of by his parents. She respected and liked Duraid, but sometimes in the night she still burned for the feel of a body as firm and young as her own on top of hers. Duraid was still speaking, and she had not been listening to him. She gave him her full attention at once. "I have spoken to the minister again, but I do not think he believes in me. I think that Nahut has convinced him that I am a little mad." He smiled sadly. Nahut Guddabi was his ambitious and well-connected deputy. "At any rate, the minister says that there are no government funds available, and that I will have to seek outside finance. So I have been over the list of possible sponsors again, and have narrowed it down to four. There is the Getty Museum, of course, but I never like to work with a big impersonal institution. I prefer to have a single man to answer to. Decisions are always easier to reach." None of this was new to her, but she listened dutifully. "Then there is Herr von Schiller. He has the money and the interest in the subject, but I do not know him well enough to trust him entirely." He paused, and Royan had listened to these musings so often before that she could anticipate him. "What about the American? He is a famous collector," she forestalled him. "Peter Walsh is a difficult man to work with. His passion to accumulate makes him unscrupulous. He frightens me a little." "So who does that leave?" she asked. He did not reply, for they both knew the answer to her question. Instead, he turned his attention back to the material that littered the work table. "It looks so innocent, so mundane. An old papyrus scroll, a few photographs and notebooks, a computer printout. It is difficult to believe how dangerous these might be in the wrong hands." He sighed again. "You might almost say that they are deadly dangerous." Then he laughed. "Ha ha, but I am being fanciful. Perhaps it is the late hour. Shall we get back to work? We can worry about these other matters once we have worked out all the conundrums set for us by this old rogue, Taita, and completed the translation." He picked up the top photograph from the pile in front of him. It was an extract from the central section of the scroll. "It is the worst luck that the damaged piece of papyrus falls where it does." He picked up his reading glasses and placed them on his nose before he read aloud. "There are many steps to ascend on the staircase to the abode of Hapi. With much hardship and endeavour, we reached the second step and proceeded no further, for it was here that the prince received a divine revelation. In a dream, his father, the dead god Pharaoh, visited him and commanded him, 'I have travelled far, and I am grown weary. It is here that I will rest for all eternity.'" Duraid removed his glasses and looked across at Royan. "The second step. It is a very precise description for once. Taita is not being his usual devious self." "Let's go back to the satellite photographs," Royan suggested, and drew the glossy sheet towards her. Duraid came around the table to stand behind her. "To me it seems most logical that the natural feature that would obstruct them in the gorge would be something like a set of rapids, or a waterfall. If it were the second waterfall, that would put them here." Royan placed her finger on a spot on the satellite photograph where the narrow snake of the river threaded itself through the dark massifs of the mountains on either hand. At that moment she was distracted, and she lifted her head. "Listen," Her voice changed, sharpening with alarm. What is it? Duryad looked up also. The dog, she answered. Oh, that damned mongrel, he agreed. It is always making the night hideous with its yapping. I have promised myself to get rid of him. At that moment, the lights went out. They froze with surprise in the darkness. The soft thudding of the decrepit diesel generator in its shed at the back of the palm grove had ceased. It was so much a part of the oasis night that they noticed it only when it was silent. Their eyes adjusted to the faint starlight that came in through the terrace doors. Duryad crossed the room and took the oil lamp down from the shelf beside the door, where it waited for just such a contingency. He lit it and looked across at Royan with an expression of comical resignation. I will have to go down. Duryad, she interrupted him. The dog. He listened for a moment, and his expression changed to mild concern. The dog was silent out there in the night. I am sure it is nothing to be alarmed about. He went to the door, and for no good reason, she suddenly called after him. Duryad, be careful. He shrugged dismissively and stepped out onto the terrace. She thought for an instant that it was the shadow of the vine over the trellis moving in the night breeze off the desert. But the night was still. Then she realized that it was a human figure crossing the flagstones, silently and swiftly, coming in behind Duryad as he skirted the fishpond in the centre of the paved terrace. Duryad! She screamed a warning, and he spun round, lifting the lamp high. Who are you? He shouted. What do you want here? The intruder closed with him silently. The traditional full-length dishdasha robe swirled around his legs, and the white gutra headcloth covered his head. In the light of the lamp, Duryad saw that he had drawn the corner of the headcloth over his face to mask his features. The intruder's back was turned towards her, so Royan did not see the knife in his right hand, but she could not mistake the upward stabbing motion that he aimed at Duryad's stomach. Duryad grunted with pain and doubled up at the blow, and his attacker drew the blade free and stabbed again. But this time, Duryad dropped the lamp and seized the knife arm. The flame of the fallen oil lamp was guttering and flaring. The two men struggled in the gloom, but Royan saw a dark stain spreading over her husband's white shirt front. Run! He bellowed at her. Go! Fetch help! I cannot hold him! The Duryad, she knew, was a gentle person, a soft man of books and learning. She could see that he was outmatched by his assailant. Go, please! Save yourself, my flower! She could hear by his tone that he was weakening, but he still clung desperately to his attacker's knife arm. She had been paralyzed with shock and indecision these few fatal seconds, but now she broke free of the spell and ran to the door. Spurred by her terror and her need to bring help to Duryad, she crossed the terrace swift as a cat, and he held the intruder from blocking her way. She vaulted over the low stone wall into the grove and almost into the arms of the second man. She screamed and twisted away from him as his outstretched fingers raked across her face and almost broke free. But his fingers hooked in the thin cotton stuff of her blouse. This time she saw the knife in his hand, a long silvery flash in the starlight, and it goaded her to fresh effort. The cotton tore in his grip and she was free, but not quickly enough to escape the blade. She felt the sting of it across her upper arm, and she kicked out at him with all the strength of panic in her hard young body behind it. She felt her foot slam into the softness of his lower body with a knock that jarred her knee and ankle, and her attacker cried out and fell to his knees. Then she was away and running through the palm grove. At first she ran without purpose or direction. She ran simply to get as far from them as her flying legs would carry her. Then gradually she brought her panic under control. She glanced back, but saw nobody following her. As she reached the edge of the lake, she slowed her run to conserve her strength, and she became aware of the warm trickle of her own blood down her arm, and then dripping from her fingertips. She stopped and rested her back against the rough bole of one of the palms, while she tore a strip of cloth from her ripped blouse and hurriedly bound up her arm. She was shaking so much from shock and exertion that even her uninjured hand was fumbling and clumsy. She knotted the crude bandage with her teeth and left hand, and the bleeding slowed. She was uncertain of which way to run, and then she saw the dim lamplight in the window of Alia's shack across the nearest irrigation canal. She pushed herself away from the palm trunk and started towards it. She had covered less than 100 paces when a voice called from the grove behind her, speaking in Arabic, "Yusuf, has the woman come your way?" Immediately an electric torch flashed from the darkness ahead of her, and another voice called back, "No, I have not seen her." Another few seconds and Royan would have run full into him. She crouched down and looked around her desperately. There was another torch coming through the grove behind her, following the path she had taken. It must be the man she had kicked, but she could tell by the motion of the torch beam that he had recovered and was moving swiftly and easily again. She was blocked on two sides, so she turned back along the edge of the lake. The road lay that way. She might be able to meet a late vehicle travelling on it. She lost her footing on the rough ground and went down, bruising and scraping her knees, but she jumped up again and hurried on. The second time she stumbled, her out-thrust left hand landed on a round, smooth stone the size of an orange. When she went on, she carried the stone with her. As a weapon, it gave her a glimmer of comfort. Her wounded arm was beginning to hurt, and she was driven by worry for Jurayid. She knew he was badly wounded, for she had seen the direction and force of the knife thrust. She had to find help for him. Behind her, the two men with torches were sweeping the grove, and she could not keep her lead ahead of them. They were gaining on her. She could hear them calling to each other. She reached the road at last, and with a small whimper of relief, climbed out of the drainage ditch onto the pale gravel surface. Her legs were shaking under her, so that they could hardly carry her weight, but she turned in the direction of the village. She had not reached the first bend before she saw a set of headlights coming slowly towards her, flickering through the palm trees. She broke into a run down the centre of the road. "Help me!" she screamed in Arabic. "Please help me!" The car came through the bend, and before the headlights dazzled her, she saw that it was a small, dark-coloured Fiat. She stood in the centre of the road, waving her arms to halt the driver, lit by the headlights as though she were on a theatre stage. The Fiat stopped in front of her, and she ran round to the driver's door and tugged at the handle. "Please, you must help me!" The door was opened from within, and then was thrown back with such force that she staggered off balance. The driver leapt out into the roadway and caught her by the wrist of the injured arm. He dragged her to the Fiat and pulled open the back door. "Yusuf! Bakshit!" he shouted into the dark grove. "I have her!" And she heard the answering cries and saw the torches turn in their direction. The driver was forcing her head down and trying to push her into the back seat, but she realized then that she still had the stone in her good hand. She turned slightly and braced herself, and then swung her fist with the stone still clenched in it against the side of his head. It caught him squarely on the temple. Without another sound, he dropped to the gravel surface and lay motionless. Royan dropped the stone and pelted away down the road, but she found that she was running straight down the path of the headlights, and they lit her every movement. The two men in the grove shouted again and came up onto the gravel roadway behind her, almost shoulder to shoulder. Glancing back, she saw them gaining on her swiftly, and she realized that her only chance was to get off the road and back into the darkness. She turned and plunged down the bank. Immediately she found herself waist-deep in the waters of the lake. In the darkness and the confusion, she had become disorientated. She had not realized that she had reached the point where the road skirted the embankment at the water's edge. She knew that she did not have time to climb back onto the road, and she knew also that there were thick clumps of papyrus and reeds ahead of her that might give her shelter.